listening to the Warden Alumni Executive Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast. I am your host, Alex Gromatsky, and today I'm going to be talking to Michael Wolf, who was at the U.S. Navy for 12 years and was a lieutenant commander and senior regional flight surgeon over there. And now he's a consultant at the Mayo Clinic. So thank you for being on today.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. Great to be here.
Yeah, so let's start a little bit about the U.S. Navy and some of your background there. I had a chance to look a little bit into your history, but can you expand a little bit on what that role was and what that experience was like for you? That sounds really impressive.
Well, thank you very much. Admittedly, I have a pretty unusual and non-traditional background. I say that I was a corporate medical director by background. Actually, going way back, I started out as a paramedic, went to college a little bit late, and then medical school at the Uniformed Services University. Came out and of my training and spent most of my military career working for senior military executives, not on the medical side, but on our operations side. My boss was essentially always an MBA. I worked always within aerospace, and I sat on the equivalent of a corporate board. And by way of scale, the last organization I was with before getting out was about a $6.5 billion organization. We had over 100 aircraft, 15 maintenance facilities around the globe, and over 3,000 personnel. And I was responsible for health, safety, and risk management, and sat next to human resources and finance at in a boardroom on every Tuesday morning for our weekly meetings. Was involved in some great value creation projects, some acquisitions programs. We did a $4.4 billion acquisition of aircraft from Boeing during my time there. And I was investing in productivity and healthcare programs for the organization to keep aircraft in the air and people at work. And I guess by way of my training, along the way, went back, earned a master's in informatics, did my postgraduate training at Penn in the School of Medicine, a program geared towards corporate medical directors, and worked with the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics, did a postgraduate business fellowship with Salesforce and Jawbone Health. And when I got out of the military in 2019, really kind of surprisingly to me, ended up at Mayo Clinic. I was looking at business roles, mostly consulting roles, and was lucky enough to end here in a faculty role that allowed me to, obviously practice as a physician, but also expand upon my business background. Mayo during those years and today was really expanding into digital health. I had signed a partnership with Google and was making big investments into the digital space. And they wanted physicians who had a background in digital and in business.
Well, so, but it sounded like at the beginning, it started almost like you were a paramedic, and that's a pretty massive jump from, you know, being a paramedic, at least from my image of a paramedic and things that you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis to now doing those types of projects for the Mayo Clinic, which is one of the most recognizable medical institutions in the world. That's an incredible journey. So how do you go from being a paramedic to, you know, working at the Navy and being in those positions and those roles? And you expand a little bit about your background, but I feel like there's a lot of context that the listeners would like to hear about as well that I'm curious about.
Sure. You know, I say that I've worked at the intersections of government, academia, and industry over 25 years. And really, these are very operational roles. And I think that's the commonality. I've had the opportunity to lead people. I've had the opportunity to lead organizations, manage programs and projects. Certainly the common thread here is healthcare, but a lot of it is accomplishing really complex projects and tasks, organizing, I mean, as a paramedic, sort of organizing chaos and developing systems and people. And that's continued to today and now funding those programs. So I think that has served me well over the years, and I still put that to work, particularly on the investing side and the business development side.
Yeah, and when you're at the Navy, you mentioned on some incredible projects like the work with Boeing and things like that sounded like some big things. What are some things that people would have to think about when they're working with the Navy and working on such multi-billion dollar projects that you had to encounter, some of the obstacles, some of the wins that you had along the way, things like that?
Well, one of the big programs and projects that I'm very proud of, and it's carried through to today. But it was what started my interest in finance and investing was developing models and developing financial justification for investment and productivity and healthcare services. I started taking a look at what the cost of lost work time and productivity was. And frankly, this started from really looking at the cost of aircraft that were unable to fly. I remember one day we had an aircraft that was grounded because we didn't have a welder who was qualified for a particular type of welding who could do the job. And this was, you know, like a 22, 23 year old welder. And I found myself asking the question, you know, we have a $100 million asset that can't be put to use because of somebody who, you know, really isn't making that much money. And what would it cost to get them back to work? And what is the cost of their lost work time? It's not whatever we think we're paying them, you know, $30 an hour, or perhaps even less, but it's some depreciated cost of a $100 million asset. And at the time, we really weren't working with numbers in that way. We were looking at the KPI that we used was the maintenance man hour, understanding how many maintenance hours it took to keep an aircraft in the air. And I wanted to put financial value to that and started building a financial model to what that maintenance man hour cost, what lost work time cost, and use that for justification for healthcare expenditure. And really propelled my career forward.
Yeah, and was that just intuitive to you to look at that and say, well, this doesn't make sense because, you know, this is, like you said, a $100 million aircraft, and for this to be sitting here, just it doesn't seem quite right, and therefore you thought that there should be a different approach, or do you still always have an interest in finance and just look at things a little bit differently?
I think it was somewhat intuitive to me. I mean, I would say that I've always had something of an interest in it, but you know, you always have I would say that we often would have the values conversation. You know, I would come to the table and I'd say, we need to invest in this. This makes sense. This is good for the patients. And everybody at the table would say, yeah, we agree in quality healthcare. Find me the money to pay for it. And I would kind of take that as a challenge and say, okay, let me figure out how we can pay for it. Let me see how we can make that happen. And so it became I would start to reframe the conversation and say, okay, we all have shared values. We all agree that we want quality healthcare. Now the competition is how to pay for it. And let me demonstrate to you that it's actually cost effective for us to invest in this way, and that the productivity of the organization can translate from keeping your people healthy.
That's a very interesting approach. So essentially focusing on the people first, making sure that they're healthy, that leads to, you know, them being able to service the assets in a better way, the assets generate a return, or in some cases the people do directly. And so you kind of looked at it from that approach as to what do we need to be able to actually generate a return or to generate output?
Absolutely. And in large organizations, this could be astronomical, even in smaller organizations. You figure that there's a percentage of your people who will always be have to be out of work, who are sick or injured or have reasons why they have to be away from the office. But then there's another factor that we often look at that we often call presenteeism, who have to be out temporarily, maybe on light duty, desk work, maybe aren't at their best for some reason or another. I often, in the numbers that I've looked at and put together, this usually about 1-2% of your population. If you can decrease that by some amount, you know, by investing in your people, keeping them healthier, keeping them happier at work, you can save a tremendous amount of money in your operations.
And then how did you, or what made you decide to go and jump from the Navy to the Mayo Clinic? Because, you know, the Navy is a massive organization. Well, I don't know how many people are involved in total in that whole enterprise and how big it spans and how many cross functions there are. But
well, Department of Defense wide, it's about 2.15 million people, service members. Mayo Clinic is about 73,000.
Yeah, right.
Our entire enterprise.
Yeah, so you're going from essentially a massive organization, which has a lot of funding behind it, arguably infinite, so they can just continue to print more money, but that's a whole other conversation. To going to the Mayo Clinic, which is also a very reputable organization. How do you decide to make that move as a human being, like as a person? Like, what makes you do that?
Well, first of all, I'll say it's a little bit scary. I was in the military for 14 years, and a government employee of various forms for boy, 8 or 9 years before that. So, moving over completely takes a little bit of a leap of faith, but it's exciting, and there are a lot of other opportunities in the private sector, or at least the nonprofit sector. So, it was very exciting. There were a lot of new challenges, and when I decided that I was going to go some different directions, I already mentioned I was looking at, frankly, more opportunities in the banking and consulting industry, and that's where I thought I was going to end up. The opportunity at Mayo Clinic, I frankly give a tremendous amount of credit to University of Pennsylvania. I've been very proud of my affiliation there. I had obviously done my postdoctoral training there, and I believe somebody at Mayo Clinic got my name from somebody at Penn, and that's how I ended up getting recruited.
Oh, so it was a recruitment situation, and but you were thinking about moving in general. Word kind of got out that you were thinking about moving. You thought it was going to be banking, but then you ended up at the Mayo Clinic.
Yes, I'd already given my notice to the military, so I already knew I was getting out. I'd actually already interviewed at some consulting firms and banks. Mayo Clinic was, frankly, a later entrant to that conversation. They interviewed me, made me an offer very quickly. I think I interviewed on a Friday and had an offer on Monday, and the timing and everything else aligned. It was pretty hard to pass up.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you're a hot commodity in that front, but on the other side, you also gave notice before you had something firm lined up, which is something else that I don't know that many people really do that, or do they? I don't know.
Well, obviously there are a lot of factors, considerations that go into where you end up. This was good alignment, so I felt very lucky.
Okay, awesome. And then what is it that you focus on at the Mayo Clinic? Like, what's your, year or day-to-day look like? What are the things you're focusing on?
Boy, it's complex to describe that. No 2 days are exactly the same. Mayo Clinic is unique. Academia is unique. I'll first start out by saying that at Mayo Clinic, if you have an MD behind your name, if you're a physician, every physician has to see patients. Mayo Clinic prides itself on being a physician-led organization. They want you to be in touch with what they do, and what it means to serve patients and to take care of patients. So I will say that every department at Mayo Clinic has a physician lead and an administrative lead, and they work in partnership with each other. So you have to have a portion of your time that is clinical. In addition to that, we're all expected to also do some research and to teach. So I'm involved in all of those arms. The last part for me, which is considerable, is on the business development and venture side, and I am on the for a very significant portion of our operations. I'm on the business development executive committee for Department of Medicine. So I have a role there, meeting for how we invest and how we develop strategy for where the organization is going. So a lot of talk about where healthcare is going and where we want to take the organization.
And in your opinion, where is healthcare going? Because I hear about things like telehealth and virtual health, but that's maybe proactive healthcare or maybe some of the chronic stuff and follow-up stuff. But you coming from being a paramedic for very long, of course, there's like urgent care and things like that as well, and where care needs to actually be provided on site and it's very precise. So it's pretty broad on that perspective as to what health really means also. But what's your interpretation of that?
Boy, first of all, I let me preface this, that none of what I'm going to say is speaking for the organization. This is from my personal view. But I think everybody's in agreement. This is a very exciting time for healthcare. This is a very exciting time for technology. Everything is changing very quickly. And it's been amplified by, frankly, COVID. We've moved things along very, very quickly. There's definitely a movement towards digital solutions. It's definitely a movement towards remote technologies. I think obviously what's going on in the AI space is phenomenal and opens up all sorts of opportunities. We don't even know where this will take us yet, but we know that it's exciting and that we know that there will be some new opportunities. There is a lot of opportunity in virtual worlds, virtual care, the metaverse, and obviously in telehealth. What I am saying is that I think that healthcare will be entirely different 10 years from now than what we're envisioning today. I think that these next 10 years will be incredibly formative, both in how we deliver care as well as in how we pay for it. So I'm excited to see how it's transforming.
I haven't really considered how we paid for it yet. So can you expand a little bit on that? Because I haven't really read much about it or researched or heard much about how paying for it might change. Because in my head, it's, you know, insurance or self-pay.
Yes, I think that's one of the discussions that is going on in the background, that's developing in the background. I think embedded in all of these discussions about staff burnout, in retention issues, in staffing issues, we're going to have to acknowledge and discuss the payment issues, the compensation issues, the payer issues. And the models that we have within healthcare are admittedly imperfect. And so I think that that is in the works for sort of reinvention and re-exploration. In addition to that, as we're becoming more virtual, we're having to rethink how we bill for this. You know, fee-for-service, procedure-based billing doesn't necessarily work as well when so much of the care is becoming more virtual. So we're at a branch point here. We're at a crossroads in healthcare, and I think that we're going to see a lot of changes.
That's a good point, because that reminds me of a discussion I had with Srika, who does or who helps companies on or hospitals, a lot of them, with managing their assets, whether they're tangible or intangible, and doing a lot of those components around that. And he mentioned that a lot of hospitals essentially have emergency care, which brings in extra revenue as well. But really, your customer base is essentially, we'll call it your zip code, for lack of a better word. But like you said, with telehealth and virtual care, that might not be true anymore if you can, as an organization or as a hospital, expand that reach beyond your zip code into, you know, other areas and other countries, maybe even potentially on that side of things. But as you said, you know, people aren't just going to come there and get a surgery, because a lot of the time talking to the doctor, I don't know if it's free or not free, so to speak, and it's all covered somewhere in the billing. But now if you're talking to people mostly virtually, and very few of the people are actually coming in for procedures, that could really change things. Kind of what I heard you say, if that's correct.
Absolutely. I mean, healthcare is moving beyond the four walls. I mean, what we used to think as a model of care where you went to a clinician within a fixed facility, sort of the ivory towers of old, is completely changing. And even, you know, 5 years ago, we were moving towards the minute clinic model and urgent care and clinics in non-traditional spaces. Now we're moving towards virtual care, we're moving towards hospital at home, we're moving towards the metaverse and AI solutions and AI answers and wearables in different ways than we ever thought of implementing them. The billing models, the care delivery models, all of this has to be reinvented together.
So it reminds me a little bit of the banking sector then, because, you know, in the past when all banks were just, we'll say, cash or checks, everyone had to go into their bank and had to do their banking business in the bank. And now a lot of banking is done online. And the branch location is less important. And I talked to somebody else when they said, no, buying a bank, it's not important how many locations they have anymore. Like, it's more important, you know, what's their reoccurring revenue model? Like, how are they reaching customers? And it sounds to me a little bit that that healthcare might be in a similar space that banking has gone through, where maybe you can have some of the larger companies, you know, buying or merging with smaller hospitals, with smaller organizations, acquire essentially those customers, get that reach, and the location itself might be less important because less people are going there, but there's more physicians, there's more nurses, there's more infrastructure in place to maybe service these people and kind of change things around.
Absolutely. And I love that way of thinking. I think it's a great comparison to the banking universe, the banking industry. I think my friends and colleagues would agree and laugh that I'm one who likes to talk about getting out of our silos. I like looking externally, not at what other people are doing in healthcare, but what other industries are doing. And I say, what do we have to learn from, you know, consumer product goods? What do we have to learn from, every other industry out there? How are they doing things at Amazon? How are they doing things at Cisco? I had a conversation with an executive at Intel recently. I think that's where we need to be looking, because some of these problems have been dealt with previously. So I frequently say we're special, but we're not that special. Let's figure out what the lessons are that we need to import to our own community.
Because my limited understanding is Mayo is a lot of cancer related, I guess, surgeries and procedures and treatments. And I don't really know the revenue model of something like the Mayo Clinic. I can understand a hospital, like people come in, but Mayo is, I think, even much more global than a lot of people from all over the world come in. So can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. We often speak of ourselves as a destination medical center. So a huge percentage of our base are flying here from other parts of the country and indeed the world, and they come here for specialty care. So we are a quaternary medical center. People come here for second, third, fourth opinions, for complex care, and we have wide-ranging expertise across disciplines where we can coordinate care and do so very quickly.
So you have broad experience in a few different areas, from healthcare to finance to, you know, having to deal with planes and aircraft. What is it that you had to master or become good at to be able to, you know, take this broad experience and then apply it for what you're doing today?
So I think the lesson for me was to be adaptable and learn the skills you had to learn to exceed in the position. And I think that's not unique, particularly coming from the military. I feel like all of my military friends have had to do that. You get thrust into a role with expectations, with objectives, and you have to buckle down and learn the skills that you need to succeed. So sometimes those are not your objectives. That might not be where you expected your career to develop. But you need to develop the competencies to make it happen.
Yeah, and that's so interesting, because it's a skill that keeps on growing, because as the environment changes, you have to keep changing, you have to continue to be adaptable. So that adaptability requirement is very different from, you know, back in the day when people were just in the workforce and they had a very specific project, a very specific task to do. And sure, you might have become an excellent carpenter, or you might have become excellent at a specific trade, but that's not what you have to do. You have to continuously look around as to what's changing, how is it changing, and what information do you need to pick up to be able to perform your job?
Absolutely. I mean, the lesson we used to teach to junior military officers was, you know, you may know nothing about being an auto mechanic, but you could be put in charge of managing the auto shop and a bunch of junior folks who are excellent mechanics. It's incumbent upon you to go out there and look under the hood and ask questions and learn what they do. You may not be in some cases, the best auto mechanic at the end of the day, but you have to be informed enough to be able to lead and manage those departments. In some cases, though, I think that it is important to become an expert in those areas. In my case, I'll credit Wharton. I said, I want to be expert in finance. I really want to be double down on this. I think that this is important enough that this is where I want to plant a stake and really learn this well. I don't want to just be, okay at this. And frankly, early on in my career, when I was doing my postdoctoral training at Perelman School of Medicine, I went and saw Dr. Yilmaz, Bilge Yilmaz, and I sought him out and I said, I want to learn this and I want to be very good at it. And it's actually in those very early years, he provided me some great guidance and introduced me to the executive programs. He provided me some reading very early on and actually started helping me craft my career in this direction.
Completely off topic, but a little bit on topic. Isn't Bilge Yilmaz doing something in Turkey now, like governmental?
He is, yes. So he's, I believe he's very involved in the economics and the monetary system and the politics there.
Yeah, I just saw that in the news feed recently. Yeah, I had him as a private equity professor as well, so I followed that a little bit. But this idea of wanting to become excellent, where did that come from? Was that from you having to, face an obstacle and being like, man, I wish I knew how to do this? Or was this just innately you've always wanted to be excellent in certain areas? Because achieving excellent in one area, is probably doable, but in the many areas that you've come across, it's probably very hard.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a, what it is. I suppose I'm not good at doing something halfway. When I learn something, I want to master it. I want to be very good at it. Generally, I suppose a lot of us are like that. That's what makes us who we are and want to be high achieving. But I also recognize the importance of some of these competencies and said, this is important enough and I'm passionate about this and feel that it's significant and where I want to go in my career.
So then if we can go back in time, you said, this is where you want to go in your career. Where did you think you wanted to go 20 years ago? Like if you go back to university or doing your undergrad, what did you think your career was going to turn out like?
I was obviously headed towards medicine. I knew I wanted to, and that was, I'm trying to think of where I was at 20 years ago, but I was headed to medical school. I had already been a paramedic. I knew that I wanted to be a physician, and part of my drive to become a physician was to be a leader within medicine. And I felt that to make the impacts that I wanted to make, I needed the background and the breadth of experience and training that medical school would bring me. And quite frankly, I see finance as something of an extension of that. I've had now the experience of being able to direct, tens of millions of dollars towards healthcare clinics and investment in healthcare. And your impact as a physician, if you can direct that money, is astronomical. I mean, I'm very proud of the impact that I've made to individual patients, but when you put millions of dollars in the right place, you change the healthcare for populations. And that's very, very impactful. And I'm proud that I'm able to make that impact as a physician.
Can you share a little bit about more of that as it relates to, you said, the impact on the communities or, the millions of dollars being put towards specific things? Because that does sound really impactful and I'd like to better understand that.
Well, I think that it's about appreciating that a healthcare clinic in the right place, the right services in the right place, or helping to develop, in my view, the right technologies can be very, very impactful for health, for quality of life on population scale. There's no way you can take care as a single person of as many people in a single workday as an entire healthcare clinic can, or save as many lives as the right drug or medical product can.
So investment could mean, like you mentioned, investing into a specific drug, or could also mean like investing into a certain surgical robotic arm, or could also mean just investing into, you know, the IT system so there's better management and able to pull things. So
that's what's true. Delivery of healthcare or health technologies in general.
Okay. And what's your thoughts on consumer facing health tech products? You know, they've probably come a long way in the last like 10 years. I know even 5 years ago, they've been, you know, somewhat poor. They could maybe count your steps and check your heart rate. And now they seem to be doing a few extra things. Do you think where things are going, technology is going to get to a point where you can have essentially real-time biometrics coming to people at home and then it's being transmitted to a doctor or a hospital for interpretation? Or, you know, is that still quite a ways away? Because, you know, some of these technologies, I'm thinking MRI machines, like they're just so big, right? You'd really need to have them in a big space.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we already have some of those technologies available. I mean, from the scale of individual wearables, you know, at the most simple basic end, the Apple Watch, there are some even more complex versions of wearables. There are a number of organizations or companies, Mayo Clinic included, who are implementing programs like Hospital at Home that allow some very advanced care, even ICU level care, within an individual's home environment. And those are phenomenal advances in remote monitoring, remote care by physicians, by, you know, subspecialist physicians. Now, when it comes to, you know, procedural care, things like an MRI that are require fixed resources, that may be a bridge too far right now, and perhaps ever, just because of the physics of that, the weight of the equipment, the size of the equipment. But it deserves all of, I never say never. Technology is always developing. I mean, we're doing things now that we never dreamed of 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, no, and that's why I was asking, because I'm not even sure how accurate these wearables are, or if, you know, a doctor saw them or somebody at the Mayo Clinic said, you know, here's my Apple Watch data and say, you know, forget about it. We need to, you know, take all these biometrics again, or we need to take all these heart rates again, or whatever the case is.
Some of them are excellent and some of them are very good. Some of them you have to appreciate them for what they are. Some of them are good for screening, but not for ultimate diagnosis. They all have their different roles.
Okay, well, that's kind of what my question was about as it relates to like wearables and where technology is at, because from a consumer perspective, I have no idea, right? They could be telling me anything. And
and admittedly, some are novelties as well, but there are some that are fantastic for diagnostics and that we use very reliably.
Okay, and one more question I have that I like to ask is, where do you think your career is going from here? Because, you know, you worked with the Navy, which is probably the largest employer in the United States, or the Department of Defense is probably one of the largest employers with 2+ million people you mentioned in there. Now you're working with, you know, the most recognizable medical institution, I think, in the world, being the Mayo Clinic, as far as I know. I could be wrong. So what's kind of left for you on the career perspective?
Well, I think my career continues to develop. Mayo Clinic has been fantastic. I love my role here. I'm a full consultant and feel very lucky to be a part of the faculty. I think it's continuing to develop on the finance side and business development side. So we'll see where it goes from here.
And what's one of the biggest successes that you've had, you know, given that you've come across so many different things?
That's often a tough question. You know, one of the successes that I'm very proud of, and maybe it's a little bit out of my career path and out of the line with some of the other things that I've worked on, but it was a huge feat to accomplish, and I feel like it made a significant impact for a lot of people. Was when I was in the military, I wrote a white paper proposing a change of health benefits. And it went all the way up to the Surgeon General and the director of the Defense Health Agency, the three-star. And it proposed that service members who were being treated for cancer should get reproductive health care benefits. So reproductive health benefits if they're getting chemotherapy and radiation therapy and could not otherwise be able to conceive. It's something that some of the other large employers have started to provide. So IVF and assisted reproductive technologies. And it took a while and took review, but ultimately the benefits were changed and they now provide it for every service member in the United States, so over 2 million service members. So I was very proud of that win. I think it was reinforcing that the system works and that, you know, even though it's sometimes feels like a large, particularly for our junior service members, can feel like a very large and faceless government, that you can make these things happen, and people want to take care of people and want to see them do well. So I was very proud of that win, and we were able to get it done.
That's incredible. Good for you. And that was earlier on in your career as well. So that must have felt really good.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thanks for sharing some of these wins, some of these insights, what your journey has been. It's been really insightful for me to get to know you a little bit more, and hopefully for a lot of our listeners as well. Is there anything else you want to add or share?
No, I really appreciate your having me. I'm grateful for having me on the program. You know, I always want to express my gratitude to Penn and to Wharton for everything that I've gotten from this community and from the alumni community. And I'm just so happy to be able to give back in any way that I can.
Well, thank you for being on today. This is already a great start.
Thank you so much, Alex.